All right, so are you ready to dive deep?
I am. Let's do it.
Okay, excellent. So today we're going to be taking a look at Daniel 8.
Ooh, Daniel 8. That's a good one.
It's a really, really fascinating chapter, and I think people have been debating it for centuries, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So just to kind of give everybody a little bit of an overview, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be taking a look at a lecture by Robert Van Noy.
Okay.
And he really kind of dives into this chapter. And then from there, we're going to talk about different approaches to interpreting the book of Daniel.
All right. Sounds good.
So Daniel 8, it's like, you know, kings and horns and battles for like the soul of a nation. Like it's got all that good stuff, right?
Yeah, it's packed.
It really is. And it's got, you know, it's got a lot of implications in terms of how we understand the whole book of Daniel.
For sure. For sure.
So let's jump into it.
Okay.
So Daniel 8 starts off with a vision, right?
Right.
And in this vision, there's a ram with two horns. What do you think that represents?
Well, a lot of scholars believe that the ram with two horns represents the Medo-Persian Empire.
The Medo-Persian Empire. And the Medo-Persian Empire, I mean, that was like a major, major empire at the time, right?
Huge. Yeah. Dominant force.
Yeah, absolutely. So then we see that this ram with two horns is defeated by a goat with a single prominent horn. And this goat, most scholars believe, represents Alexander the Great.
Right. Which makes sense when you look at history.
Yeah.
Alexander the Great conquering the Persian Empire.
Yeah.
It was pretty decisive victory.
Yeah. And it was really quick, too, right?
Yeah.
Like, he just came in and was like, boom, I'm taking over.
Exactly. A very swift conquest.
Yeah, absolutely. So Alexander the Great takes over. And then after his death, the vision shows this goat's kingdom. It gets split into four parts.
Okay.
And these four parts are represented by four horns.
So, again, we see this mirroring of history in the vision. Yeah. After Alexander died, his vast empire was divided up amongst his generals.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Leading to lots of conflict and fragmentation. You can already see the seeds of that being sown right there in the vision.
Yeah, absolutely. And then from one of these divisions, a little horn emerges.
Okay.
And this little horn, it grows in power and it starts to oppress others.
This is where things get really interesting.
Yeah.
This little horn, its interpretation has some pretty big implications for the whole book.
Right.
You know, a lot of scholars believe that this little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes the Third.
Antiochus Epiphanes the Third.
Yeah.
And he was a
Seleucid king, basically one of the rulers who emerged from the remnants of Alexander's empire.
Okay.
And he persecuted the Jewish people in the 2nd century BC.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're talking about a real historical figure whose actions seem to line up with what this little horn is doing in the vision.
Okay.
So the vision describes the horn magnifying itself against the prince of the host, which is, you know, a pretty clear reference to God.
Right. Okay.
Then we see the daily sacrifice being taken away and the sanctuary being, like, desecrated, right?
Yeah.
And this really parallels what Antiochus Epiphanes did when he tried to suppress Jewish worship and defile the temple in Jerusalem.
So can you go into a little bit more detail about the historical context? Like, what exactly was Antiochus Epiphanes trying to do?
Well, he was basically trying to Hellenize the Jewish people.
Hellenize.
Yeah. To impose Greek culture and religion on them. You know, he outlawed Jewish practices. He even set up an altar to Zeus in the temple.
Oh, wow.
And sacrificed pigs on it.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
And that's, you know, obviously a major act of desecration in the eyes of the Jewish people.
Yeah, it seems like he was really trying to provoke them.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he definitely succeeded. I mean, his action sparked a rebellion led by the Maccabees.
Oh, right. The Maccabees.
All right. And they eventually rededicated the temple. And there was even a period of Jewish independence. But yeah, those years under Antiochus's reign, they were pretty brutal for the Jewish people who were trying to stay true to their faith. You know, when you read Daniel 8, you can really feel the weight of that historical reality.
And it's really interesting because even the time frame of this persecution, it seems to line up with those mysterious 2300 days that the vision mentions.
Oh, yeah, the 2300 days. Now, that's a real head scratcher.
It really is.
That's one of those big chronological puzzles in Daniel 8 that have been debated for centuries.
Right.
Some scholars think they're literal days. Others think they're more like symbolic periods that represent a much longer time frame.
Wow. So, like, where do we even start with those 2300 days? How do we make sense of them?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, well, if you look at it from the literal day perspective, there are a few interesting points in history that could fit right.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, for example, you've got the murder of the high priest, Onias III, in 171 BC.
Okay.
And then Just a few years later, in 167, you've got the desecration of the temple. And then a couple of years after that, Antiochus himself kicks the bucket in 164.
Okay.
So if you think about it, if you map out that timeline from the murder of Ananias all the way to Antiochus dying, that would actually fit within the 2300-day period.
So all the pieces of the puzzle seem like they might fit together, but you mentioned that not everybody agrees with this literal interpretation, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's a lot of debate about it. Mm-hmm. You know, some scholars, like E.J. Young, they'll argue that splitting up the evening and the morning to get to 1150 days, they'll say that's not how the Hebrew understanding of a day works.
Okay.
Right. The Hebrew day, it includes both evening and morning. So the debate about how to count these days, well, it continues to be a big topic of discussion.
Yeah, it seems like this one detail, those 2300 days, it can really impact how we understand the whole timeline of events in Daniel 8. But then this brings up another question, right? Is Antiochus Epiphanes the only person that this prophecy is talking about? Like, is there a deeper meaning here? Maybe even a symbolic layer that's pointing to a future figure like the Antichrist?
Whoa. Now you're getting to the heart of it. This is where things get really interesting and where interpretations of Daniel 8 start to really branch off from one another.
Okay, hit me with it. Let's hear about these different interpretations.
Okay, so basically there are like four main camps, right?
Okay.
You've got your historical view, the futuristic view, then there's the dual fulfillment view, and then you have what's usually called the typical view.
Okay, let's break this down. Let's start with the historical view. What do those guys say?
The historical view. They're pretty straightforward. They say that the whole prophecy was completely fulfilled by Antiochus Epiphanes. End of story.
So no Antichrist, no like end times drama.
Nope, none of that. They say it's all about events that have already happened.
Okay, that's pretty clear cut. What about the futuristic view?
Now the futurists, they're on the other side of the spectrum. They're all about the end times. They think that the little horn is talking solely about a future Antichrist.
Yeah.
Someone who's going to show up in the last days and do basically what Antiochus did, but on a much larger, more devastating scale.
Oh, okay. So those are two very different takes. What about that dual fulfillment view? That sounds interesting.
Now, this was pretty cool. So the dual fulfillment view, it was made popular by the Scofield Reference Bible. And basically, it says that the prophecy has like a double meaning, you know.
Okay.
It's referring to both Antiochus in the past and a future Antichrist.
So it's like one prophecy, two fulfillments, like past and future woven together.
Exactly. The events with Antiochus kind of become like a sneak peek into what's to come.
Wow, that's fascinating. But I'm guessing not everyone is on board with this view.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Some people think that trying to find two separate fulfillments is kind of reading too much into the text. But others think it's a really compelling way to connect the past, present, and future.
I can see how it would be pretty captivating. Okay, so we've got three views down. What about the typical view? What does that one say?
Okay, so the typical view, and this is actually the one our lecturer, Robert Vannoy, seems to favor. It suggests that Antiochus is like a foreshadowing of the Antichrist, like a prototype, you know.
Oh, okay.
Not two separate fulfillments at different times, but a single pattern that reaches its ultimate expression in the Antichrist. So Antiochus embodies this model of spiritual oppression that is going to play out in the end times.
So like Antiochus is the warm-up act, and the Antichrist is the main event.
That's a great way to put it. He shows us this pattern of rebellion against God and the persecution of God's people that is ultimately going to culminate in the Antichrist. He's like a prefigurement, a sneak peek of the ultimate enemy of God and his people.
Okay, so I'm beginning to see how understanding just this one prophecy, the little horn in Daniel 8, can actually influence how we interpret the whole book.
Exactly. It's like a domino effect. The way we see the little horn affects how we see the rise and fall of empires, the nature of God's kingdom, and even the fate of humanity.
So then this brings us to a bigger question, right? How should we approach interpreting the whole book of Daniel? It seems like there are some pretty different viewpoints out there.
You're absolutely right. There are three main approaches to interpreting Daniel, and each one comes with its own set of assumptions about the book's authorship, historical accuracy, and its prophetic nature.
Okay, I'm ready to go deeper. Can you walk me through those different approaches?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with what's often called the critical approach. This view says that Daniel was actually written much later than most people think, like maybe during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes himself.
So they're saying it's not really prophecy, but more like historical fiction written to look like prophecy.
Yeah, exactly. The critical approach sees Daniel as a product of its time, a way to encourage the Jewish people during the persecution they were facing under Antiochus.
So they're saying the author wasn't really seeing the future, but just reflecting on what was happening and using Daniel to make his message sound more authoritative.
That's the idea. And this view naturally leads to questions about the historical accuracy of the book.
Mm.
For example, some critics will point out things they see as inaccuracies in Daniel's descriptions of Babylon and Persia.
Oh,
they'll say, see, these errors mean the author was writing from a later time when people didn't know as much about those earlier empires.
So they're saying the historical mistakes are proof that the book isn't really that old.
That's right. They also point out that there are some Greek words in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, that means it had to have been written after Alexander the Great, because that's when the Greek language spread.
Okay, so the history and the language are their main arguments against the traditional view of Daniel.
Yeah, and those are some pretty compelling points. But of course, not everyone agrees with them. There are plenty of scholars who strongly disagree with this whole critical approach. They'll say that the supposed inaccuracies in the book are either not really mistakes, or they can be explained in other ways.
Okay.
And they'll say that just because there are a few Greek words doesn't automatically mean the book was written late. So yeah, it's a scholarly debate with strong arguments on both sides.
A real back and forth. It seems like this is a pretty significant debate too. Like, how you view the authorship of Daniel really impacts how you interpret its message.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge deal.
Yeah.
I mean, if you believe the critics and think it was written during the Maccabean period, then it becomes primarily a book about resistance, a message for a specific historical moment.
Mm.
But if you believe it was genuinely written by Daniel back in the 6th century BC, then it's divinely inspired prophecy speaking not only to that time, but also to the future.
Wow. It's amazing how one book can spark so much discussion and debate.
Daniel is definitely a book that makes us think and wrestle with some big questions. But let's move on to the second approach, the one that's often called the Orthodox view. This perspective is usually linked to what's called an amillennial view of eschatology.
Okay, for those of us who aren't theology experts, can you explain what amillennial means?
Sure. So amillennialism is a view that says that the millennium mentioned in Revelation 20, it's not a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth after his second coming.
Okay.
Instead, it's a symbolic way of talking about Christ's current reign in the hearts of believers and in his church.
So it's a more spiritual understanding of the millennium. Okay, how does that affect how these scholars interpret the prophecies in Daniel?
Well, those who hold this amillennial view, they tend to think that the main focus of Daniel is on the first coming of Christ and the start of his kingdom through the gospel message.
So they're putting the spotlight on the historical Jesus and the work that the church is doing now.
Exactly. A great example of this approach is E.B. Pusey. He was a 19th century scholar who wrote a lot about Daniel. He believed that the book's central message is all about the coming of Christ and how his kingdom will ultimately triumph over all earthly empires.
Okay.
Like, for instance, in Daniel 2, there's that vision of a statue made of different metals representing different kingdoms.
Right.
Pusey thought the stone that smashes the statue, that was a symbol of Christ, whose coming brings about a whole new era.
So he's looking at those images and prophecies through the lens of Jesus's first coming.
Precisely. And another scholar who takes a similar view is E.J. Young. He sees the fourth empire in Daniel, the one that's often interpreted as Rome, as the setting for Jesus's arrival and the spread of the gospel. He sees the stone striking the statue's feet as a symbol of Jesus's birth and how his life, death, and resurrection destroyed the old order and brought about a new spiritual kingdom.
It's interesting how they connect those prophecies with Jesus.
Yeah. And that's a big thing with this amillennial approach. They tend to downplay or spiritualize those prophecies about a future tribulation period or a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth. They focus more on the present reality of Christ's kingdom working through the church.
So they see Daniel as pointing to Christ and also being fulfilled in him. It's a very Christ-centered way of reading the book. What about the third approach?
All right, so the third approach, which I'll call the premillennial view, is much more future-oriented. It puts a lot of emphasis on the second coming of Christ and how the prophecies will be fulfilled in the future.
So now we're getting into end-time scenarios and the Antichrist.
You got it. This approach, which actually includes a whole bunch of different interpretations, often sees a dual fulfillment in Daniel's prophecies. Like one part related to Antiochus Epiphanes and another pointing to that future Antichrist in the last days.
So they're seeing echoes of the past and the future, with Antiochus being like a preview of what's to come with the Antichrist.
Exactly. They really focus on the details in Daniel's visions. They carefully study the symbolism, trying to connect it to events that will happen in the end times.
I can imagine how this could get pretty complex and maybe even a little speculative, especially since we're talking about things that haven't happened yet.
Oh, for sure. And within this premillennial camp, there's a lot of disagreement about how to interpret specific prophecies. Some take them very literally, while others see them as more symbolic. But the thing that unites them is their focus on the future fulfillment of prophecy, especially the second coming of Christ and the establishment of his millennial kingdom on earth.
So they see Daniel as like a roadmap to the end times.
Exactly. And many people who hold this view find a lot of comfort and encouragement in the book, especially as believers living in a world that can seem increasingly hostile to the Christian faith.
So they find hope in looking ahead to a time when God will ultimately defeat evil.
Exactly. And they often point to how the book emphasizes God's sovereignty and faithfulness, even when his people are facing persecution and suffering. For them, it's a source of strength and resilience.
It's incredible how much meaning and interpretation people can find in one book.
Daniel is truly a treasure trove of prophetic insights. But as with any part of the Bible, it's crucial to approach these different viewpoints with humility and an open mind, considering all the perspectives.
That's a great point. It's not about being stuck on one interpretation, but rather having a respectful dialogue and letting the text challenge us.
I agree. The goal is to understand what God is saying to us and how it applies to our lives now and in the future.
Okay, so we've explored these three main ways of looking at Daniel. The critical approach, the amillennial approach, and the premillennial approach. It seems like each one brings something valuable to the table. But where does Robert Van Noy, whose lecture we're focusing on, where does he fit in all of this?
Well, Van Noy seems to lean toward the premillennial view. He acknowledges the historical importance of Antiochus Epiphanes, but he also sees the possibility of the little horn prophecy pointing to a future Antichrist figure.
So he's not rejecting Daniel as just historical fiction like some of the critics do, and he's not saying that all the prophecies were fulfilled in Christ, like the amillennial view. It sounds like he's trying to find a balance between those two positions.
I think that's a good way to describe it. He sees Antiochus as a key player in Daniel 8, but he also believes that the little horn prophecy could be pointing to a future Antichrist who will have similar traits and carry out a similar kind of persecution.
So he's looking for a connection between the past and the future. He recognizes the historical and the prophetic.
Exactly. And he's not alone in this. Lots of scholars, especially those who come from a premillennial background, are trying to figure out how to interpret the details in Daniel's visions in a way that honors both the historical context and the prophetic implications.
It's definitely not an easy task. You don't want to force the text to say what you want it to say, but you also want to be faithful to its original meaning.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance. It takes careful study, prayer, and a willingness to let the text challenge you.
And that's what makes studying the Bible so rewarding. It's not about finding simple answers, but going on a journey of discovery and letting God's word transform our hearts and minds.
I love that. It's a journey that keeps us humble, curious, and always learning more about God in his plan.
So to sum it all up, we've explored the vision in Daniel 8. We've talked about Antiochus Epiphanes and what he did, and we tried to unpack those mysterious 2300 days. We also looked at those three main approaches to interpreting the whole book of Daniel.
Yeah, and we saw how Van Noy, while recognizing the historical importance of Antiochus, sees a potential link between the past and the future, suggesting that Antiochus might be a foreshadowing of a future Antichrist figure.
It's definitely a lot to take in, but it's such an important conversation. How we interpret Daniel affects how we understand biblical prophecy and even how we live our lives right now.
Absolutely. Well, Daniel isn't just some ancient text full of confusing symbols and predictions. It's a living word that speaks to our hopes, fears, and our desire for a world where God's justice and righteousness will finally win.
It reminds us that even when surrounded by darkness and oppression, God is still working and that he has a plan to redeem everything. It really does. And it really makes me think, you know, even though we've been looking at all these different ways of understanding Daniel, the main message still seems to come through no matter how you look at it.
Yeah, that's true. Whether you see the events as just historical or pointing to something in the future, the book ultimately points us back to God, right? His sovereignty, the faithfulness of his people, good overcoming evil.
That's really powerful, especially when you think about what's going on in the world today. Sometimes it feels like there's so much darkness, so many challenges. So, like, how do we follow Daniel's example? You know, how do we stay faithful when it feels like the culture is pushing back against everything we believe? How do we actually live that out?
I think what really strikes me about Daniel is that he always remembers who's in control. Like, he's surrounded by all these pagan rulers. There are threats against his life.
Mm-hmm.
But he never loses sight of God's sovereignty. And he doesn't compromise, right? He holds on to his faith and finds strength in prayer and obeying God's law.
His story is such a powerful example of standing up for what you believe in, even when it's hard. I mean, they threw him into a den of lions. His friends were thrown into a fiery furnace. But their faith, it never wavered.
It's so inspiring. And they didn't just sit back and accept what was happening to them. They lived out their faith, even though they were in a foreign land. They used their skills, their wisdom, to serve God and other people.
That's a good point. It's not about just hiding from the world or waiting for the end to come. It's about being active, being a positive force, and living out your faith bravely and boldly.
Absolutely. Daniel's story is a call to action. We're not just watching history unfold. We're part of God's plan.
And his story reminds us that being faithful, well, it can cost you, but it also promises something incredible. God's presence, his strength, and ultimately, his victory.
That's so true. And even in exile, Daniel never gave up hope. That's a message we need to hear today. No matter what's going on, we can hold on to the hope that God is in control, working everything for good.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Daniel 8, we've covered a lot. We looked at the symbols in the vision. We talked about what Antiochus Epiphanes did. And we tried to figure out those 2,300 days. We even explored those different ways of interpreting the whole book of Daniel. But it goes beyond just understanding it, right?
It does. It's about taking what we've learned and applying it to our lives.
Exactly. It's about asking ourselves, how can we be like Daniel? How can we be people of integrity and courage, standing firm in our faith, even when everything around us seems to be falling apart? How can we be a light in the darkness, showing God's truth and love in real, practical ways?
Those are the questions we need to be asking.
They really are. So keep diving into the book of Daniel. It's a book full of history, mystery, and hope. And maybe, just maybe, it has a special message just for us right here, right now. A message about being faithful, being brave, and believing that good will always triumph in the end.